So we read Nehemiah chapter 5. Now the men and their wives raised a great outcry against their Jewish brothers. Some were saying, "We and our sons and daughters are numerous. In order for us to eat and stay alive, we must get grain." Others were saying, "We are mortgaging our fields, our vineyards, and our homes to get grain during the famine." Still others were saying, "We have had to borrow money to pay the king's tax on our fields and vineyards. Although we are of the same flesh and blood as our countrymen, and though our sons are as good as theirs, yet we have to subject our sons and daughters to slavery. Some of our daughters have already been enslaved, but we are powerless, because our fields and our vineyards belong to others." When I heard their outcry and these charges, I was very angry. I pondered them in my mind, and then accused the nobles and officials. I told them, "You are exacting usury from your own countrymen." So I called together a large meeting to deal with them, and said, "As far as possible, we have bought back our Jewish brothers who were sold to the Gentiles. Now you are selling your brothers only for them to be sold back to us." They kept quiet, because they could find nothing to say. So I continued, "What you are doing is not right. Shouldn't you walk in the fear of our God to avoid the reproach of our Gentile enemies? I and my brothers and my men are also lending the people money and grain, but let the exacting of usury stop. Give back to them immediately their fields, vineyards, olive groves, and houses, and also the usury you're charging them, the hundredth part of the money, grain, new wine, and oil." "We will give it back," they said, "and we will not demand anything more from them. We will do as you say." Then I summoned the priests and made the nobles and officials take an oath to do what they had promised. I also shook out the folds of my robe and said, "In this way may God shake out of his house and possessions every man who does not keep this promise. So may such a man be shaken out and emptied." At this, the whole assembly said, "Amen," and praised the Lord. And the people did as they promised. Moreover, from the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, until his 32nd year, 12 years, neither I nor my brothers ate the food allotted to the governor. But the earlier governors, those preceding me, placed a heavy burden on the people and took 40 shekels of silver from them in addition to food and wine. Their assistants also lorded it over the people. But out of reverence for God, I did not act like that. Instead, I devoted myself to the work on this wall. All my men were assembled there for the work. We did not acquire any land. Furthermore, 150 Jews and officials sat at my table, as well as those who came to us from the surrounding nations. Each day, one ox, six choice sheep, and some poultry were prepared for me, and every 10 days an abundant supply of wine of all kinds. But in spite of all this, I never demanded the food allotted to the governor, because the demands were heavy on these people. Remember me with favor, O my God, for all I've done for these people. I suppose that chorus we were singing, "A New Commandment I Give Unto You, That You Love One Another," has some bearing on what Nehemiah was trying to establish in his own community, doesn't it? I guess if the devil can't discourage us by the hostility of a non-Christian world, then he will do his level best to achieve the same goal of discouragement through the failure of love of our Christian brothers and sisters. That's something you see again and again. It's a classic demonic stratagem. Because there's no simpler way of reducing the efficiency of the people of God as builders than by fomenting discord and grievance among them. "I'm not working with him, I can't cooperate with her." Energy that should be directed productively is wasted in wrangling and rivalry, and all because we're not loving one another in the way that Christ laid down. Of course, the reasons for that lovelessness, the particular focus of it, can vary. But in the case of Nehemiah, it was money that was at the root of it all, wasn't it? It's probably hard for us to imagine the scale of economic austerity under which this Jewish community was living. For a start, of course, there was the problem of the birth rate, wasn't there, in verse 2. "We and our sons and daughters are numerous." The community was growing faster than its agricultural base. So many families were finding it was hard. They had too many mouths to feed. And then there was the stress of the famine that's mentioned in verse 3. We are mortgaging our fields and our vineyards and our homes to get grain during the famine. With so much of the community's effort being expended on the wall, no doubt they were neglecting agriculture, and it only needed a minor drought or something like that to create food shortages and put a large number of families on the breadline. And then on top of all that, of course, there was the tax man, wasn't there, in verse 4. We have had to borrow money to pay the king's tax on our fields and vineyards. Remember, these Jews were a subject people. They were obliged to pay tribute each year to the Persian government, by whose grace they were being permitted to repopulate Jerusalem. And those taxes were heavy. And seeing their inadequate resources were already being drained by other things, they often couldn't get the money together. So all ways round, here was a community that were finding it very difficult to make ends meet. But while that was no doubt bad news for the majority of the Jewish community, it's clear that there were some who were managing to take advantage of the situation. Well, there always are, aren't there? Food that was no longer available for free in the fields of the farmers had to be purchased. And that meant somebody could play the role of shopkeeper. And cash that couldn't be found for the payment of the king's taxes, that had to be borrowed. So somebody could play the role of moneylender. In both cases, it was the wealthy, of course, who were in a position to exploit the situation. They had the resources to plant extra grain or to buy it in from travelling merchants and stockpile it so that when a shortage arose they could sell it at a handsome profit. They had the spare funds available to lend money to those who were financially embarrassed by their annual tax demand at a rate of interest, of course. The result was, of course, that the rich got richer and the poor were steadily getting more and more bankrupt. First, their fields had to be mortgaged as security for their loans. And when they couldn't afford the monthly repayments, the loan was foreclosed and they found themselves dispossessed. Once they were in that condition, they had no material assets to use as collateral. Their only alternative was to sell their labour or that of their children. So slavery was re-emerging within the Jewish society. As has so often been the case down through history, this kind of economic pressure was being exploited by the powerful to create division in society. The Jewish community was being split into two groups. One's tempted to say two classes. The wealthy exploiters and the poor exploited. So we read in verse 5, although we are of the same flesh and blood as our countrymen, and though our sons are as good as theirs, yet we have to subject our sons and daughters to slavery. Some of our daughters have already been enslaved, and we are powerless because our fields and our vineyards belong to others. This was an indignity these proud Jews could scarcely bear. Well, the interesting part of our study, I suppose, is to notice how Nehemiah coped with this internal division. I want to point out to you several things that I observed, which I hope came out in your study too. The first thing that struck me very forcibly was his emotional reaction when he discovered what was going on. When I heard their outcry, verse 6, I was very angry. Now I think that's quite an important sentence. We Christians often tend to be negative about the emotion of anger, don't we? Even to the extent perhaps of regarding it as sinful whenever it arises. But that would be a great exaggeration, I think, and a dangerous exaggeration, because a great deal of the drive and determination we have to get things done derives from such feelings of aggression and anger within us. People who permanently repress their aggressive and angry feelings, you know, are likely to be rather depressed, apathetic people. And Nehemiah wasn't like that at all. He was of a fiery temperament. Indeed, there are, of course, occasions when anger is a necessary moral response, quite apart from its psychological value to us. That's why the Bible repeatedly attributes anger to God. There are occasions when we ought to feel angry, when failing to feel angry betrays not a sanctified temperament, but a moral palsy in us. And Nehemiah here exemplifies that. Injustice was being perpetrated, and people were being hurt as a result. And in Nehemiah, it felt like a fire had been lit in his guts. What he literally says there is, I burned greatly. And it was that heated emotion of furious indignation which was the fuel that stoked his human energies and enabled him to deal with the situation. In the absence of that anger, his response might well have been half-hearted or apathetic. And I suppose the same is true for us. Unless we know what it's like to feel angry at the havoc which sin wreaks in the world, we're not going to be very highly motivated to do anything about it. So there was an emotional response of anger in Nehemiah. And I think that has something to teach us. But on top of that, secondly, there was a rational response, wasn't there, in verse 7. I pondered these charges in my mind, he says. Well, the New English Bible interprets the Hebrew rather well, I think, when it translates it, I mastered my feelings. Because that's exactly the thought of this verse. Nehemiah is bringing his rage under control by a process of inner reflection. Now that too is very important. Because although, as we've said, there's nothing sinful about angry feelings as such, sin can emerge out of anger, can't it? When we fail to handle those feelings of anger in a manner which is consistent with God's law and character. Righteous anger is not just anger at the right things. Righteous anger is also anger which is expressed in the right way. Uncontrolled, Nehemiah's rage would have easily led to disaster for his whole reconstruction project. I mean, just think what he might have done if he'd just blown his top and flown off the handle. For a start, he could have resigned on the spot, couldn't he? This is the last straw, he could have said. It's bad enough having Sanballat and Tobiah to cope with. To have to deal with my own fellow countrymen and have them at one another's throats, well, that's too much. They simply aren't worth it. I'm going back to Persia. Couldn't have blamed him if he'd done that, could you? Many keen Christian workers have been so frustrated and infuriated by the small-mindedness of other Christians that they have stormed off the committee or resigned from the church in that kind of way. I've had enough, they say. Sometimes their anger may be fully justified. But their abandonment of the task isn't, is it? How pleased Sanballat would have been had Nehemiah's fellow countrymen achieved what he and Tobiah had failed to achieve. Namely, Nehemiah's resignation and abandonment of the rebuilding project. Similarly, how pleased the devil is when he finds Christians giving up, not because of the hostility of a non-Christian world, but out of frustration with their Christian colleagues. That must give the devil a real laugh. But not only could Nehemiah's anger have led to resignation, it could equally well have led to enormous blunders. See, you have to remember, these nobles and officials who were doing the exploiting represented the most powerful men in the community. If they were uncooperative, there was little Nehemiah could do to prevent this class war deepening. Indeed, if this aristocracy, if they took it into their heads to oppose Nehemiah, they could have made life very difficult for him personally. This was a real political hot potato that Nehemiah had to juggle with, you see. This developing aristocracy had to change their business practices. He had to persuade them to do that. But he didn't really have any stick to beat them with. He couldn't even fire them from their office, probably, because these abuses were so widespread, it would have left no administrative framework to govern the country. Now, these were the people he was relying on who had experience in management. These were the heads of the family groupings and so on. These were the people who had power and respect. So he had to secure a voluntary agreement that involved them. He couldn't just dismiss them or get rid of them. But frankly, that would take a stroke of diplomatic genius on his part. He couldn't afford to let his heart rule his head. Angry as he was, he had to control his temper and consider his response very carefully. Now there's a great lesson for us in that, isn't there? It's very easy to get fired up with anger or with concern about something and then go off at half-cock and simply make matters worse. We may give somebody a mouthful, may make us feel better. But actually, it doesn't achieve any change in that person, does it? So was it really worth doing? No. Our goal has to be to influence other people, not to simply relieve our own guilt feelings or anger. An emotional response, yes, there has to be an emotional response, otherwise there'll be no zeal in us if we're not emotionally involved with the human situation around us. But a rational response too. We must plan our strategy. We must think about our approach. And that brings us to the third aspect of Nehemiah's response that I think is very important. A moral response. I pondered these accusations in my mind, and then I accused the nobles and officials. I told them, "You are exacting usury from your own countrymen." So I called together a large meeting to deal with them and said, "As far as possible, we have brought back our Jewish brothers who were sold to the Gentiles. Now you are selling your brothers, only for them to be sold back to us." And they kept quiet, because they could find nothing to say. So I continued, "What you are doing is not right. Shouldn't you walk in the fear of our God to avoid the reproach of our Gentile enemies?" Now, there's a huge amount, I think, in what Nehemiah is saying there, which is interesting to just take apart and analyze. Nehemiah seems to have come to the conclusion that he had three weapons at his disposal in the situation, and he needed to deploy them all. Now, one weapon he had was public opinion. The aristocracy may have been very powerful, but they were a minority. So they would be at a disadvantage if a large number of the Jewish community were present. So he doesn't call them into his office privately and have a little tete-a-tete with them, you notice. He calls a large meeting, we're told, in verse 7. See? Clever chap, this Nehemiah. A large meeting where these people would be thoroughly put on the spot. Oh, there's an important lesson for us to learn there. We Christians, maybe, who are interested or wanting to become involved in social action of one kind or another. Evil may be rampant in a society, but it is usually only so because good men are doing nothing. There are dangers in the so-called moral majority in the United States, I don't deny, but at least they have proved to us that public opinion can be mobilized for good as well as for evil. Nehemiah is a precedent in that regard. So public opinion, that was his first weapon, and he deployed that very carefully. The second weapon he had at his disposal was patriotic sentiment. See, this aristocracy may have been big businessmen, but they were also Jews, and proud of the fact. And they would find it very hard to resist an appeal to their sense of national loyalty. So can't you hear Nehemiah's repeated emphasis on this aspect? "Your own countrymen," he says, "your Jewish brothers, the reproach of the Gentiles." Don't you realize that you're treating your own Jewish kith and kin in the same way the Persians did, making slaves of them? What are foreigners going to think of us when they learn that? He says. Now, this is a very powerful application, of course, in the life of the church. When we find abuse in the church, when we find lovelessness in the church, here's an argument we too can use. What does the world outside perceive of the inner life of our Christian community? When churches are divided by class prejudice, by racial discrimination, when they find Christians compromised by corruption or by greed, what does it do to our Christian testimony? Is it any wonder they treat our message with contempt or disdain? Can you blame them for going for Hindu sects or weirdo groups of other kinds? When they see that Christians have so little loyalty and compassion for one another, so little love. Christians can be just as sensitive, or ought to be just as sensitive, as Nehemiah was to the reproach of the Gentiles. But primarily, Nehemiah's appeal here is not to public opinion or to patriotic sentiment. His primary appeal is to moral conscience. The aristocracy may have been behaving very ruthlessly, but they were human beings. They knew the difference between right and wrong. They weren't so hardened in their selfishness that they couldn't know what it meant to fear God. So Nehemiah, though he can't threaten any human sanction, he can't threaten to dismiss them or put them in prison or any of the things that maybe in a more developed community he might have been able to do, nevertheless, he adopts a judicial, a moralizing stance toward these powerful men, doesn't he? In verse 7, he says, "I accuse them." Verse 9, he says, "What you are doing is not right." And this gesture in verse 13 of shaking out the folds of his robe, that's an ancient gesture of judgment. In this way may God shake out of his house and possessions every man who does not keep his promise. As I would say, the fact that I've got no sanction against what you're doing doesn't mean that God won't judge you for it. And I'm praying he will. It's a kind of curse, you could say. Now the point behind, you see, this strongly moralizing appeal which Nehemiah is able to make is that the law of Moses specifically legislated in the economic relationships within the Jewish community. And many of those economic laws which Moses laid down were being flouted most blatantly by these nobles, and they knew it. For a start, the labor market, you see, which they were trying to set up with slavery and so on. Moses laid down strict rules about the labor market. And slavery was just not known among Jews in the same way it was known among pagan people. Similarly with the land market, there was no way a man's land could be sold freehold and he loses in this way. The whole Jubilee legislation in the Old Testament prevented that. And as for the capital market, as for this business of borrowing money, the interest rate in the law of Moses was set at zero. And all debts had to be forgiven or set aside every 7 years. So that the Jewish community was intended to be a debt-free society. In days when Christians are trying to think out a biblical response to all kinds of questions of social justice and economics, it's very instructive to think out the implications of those laws of Moses. But I think you will see very quickly that their effect, or one of their effects, was to prevent precisely the kind of class division which was developing in Nehemiah's community. These laws of Moses made it impossible for the wealthy to exploit their financial position. They couldn't monopolize the land. They couldn't reduce the poor to a permanent state of serfdom. They couldn't use their money to make more money by charging interest. Instead, the whole system of Moses' law forced people to show mercy and generosity to one another, encouraged a feeling of mutual responsibility and charity and compassion. Now, I've no doubt a century and a half in Persia had blunted Jewish perceptions on these matters. But the prophets, like Ezekiel and Haggai, and the educators, like Ezra, they had made sure that these old Mosaic principles hadn't been forgotten by the exiles. And that meant Nehemiah didn't just have public opinion and patriotism on his side. He had the consciences of these nobles on his side too. They knew what they were doing was immoral and illegal. And that's no doubt why we read in verse 8, they kept quiet because they could find nothing to say. Well, of course they could find nothing to say. They knew what Nehemiah was saying was right. That's no doubt why he felt he could confront them in this daring way. Give back to them immediately their fields, vineyards, olive groves and houses and the usury you're charging them. He could say that because they knew it was illegitimate that they had taken them in the first place. Now, of course, it took great courage to speak out in this candid way. But it wasn't the blind, foolhardy courage of a daredevil. It was the cool, calculating courage of a man in whom anger had bred not recklessness, but moral heroism. That was Nehemiah. He knew he was right. And he knew they knew he was right. And that gave him an immense sense of inner security. Now, I do think, you know, that has a great profit for us, that lesson. Because, of course, like Nehemiah too, we Christians have to confront people with the fact that they're in the wrong. There's no way we can even share the gospel in the simplest way with people in this world without confronting them with the fact that they are sinners. We have to tell them. But like Nehemiah, we've got no human sanctions with which to intimidate them. We have to find ways of making them feel and sense the wrongness of their lifestyle before God. And just like Nehemiah, we have an advantage in that. Because they're human beings made in the image of God, they have the stamp of God's moral law on their hearts, and for that reason, their conscience is on our side. Whenever we speak to folk, their conscience is on our side. when we're sure what we're saying to them is based on God's standards of right and wrong. They may be very hardened in their sin, very ruthless in their sin, but their conscience is on our side. It will take tact to exploit that advantage. We certainly mustn't fall into the trap of a boorish aggressiveness which will simply harden people up in their defensiveness. But neither must we be mealy-mouthed and wimpish about it, you see. There are times when people need to be told what you are doing is not right. It's only when we have the courage to point that out to people are they given the opportunity to change. But that brings us to the fourth and final aspect of Nehemiah's response, which I hope you spotted in your study. Not just an emotional response, not just a rational response, not just a moral response, but an exemplary response. I'm thinking of verses 14 and following. From the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when I was appointed to be their governor, to his 32nd year, neither I nor my brothers ate the food allotted to the governor. And so on. Now, there's a Chinese proverb I'm quite fond of quoting, which says, one showing is worth 100 sayings. It's very true. If Nehemiah had simply used his authority as governor to embarrass these officials at this big public demo and manipulated them into having to eat humble pie about the situation, while he himself was doing the very same things that they were doing, he would simply, of course, have brought contempt upon himself. The contempt both of the rich and the poor. Because nobody admires hypocrisy. If the salt loses its taste, it's good for nothing except to be trampled under the foot of men, Jesus said. My disciples have to be distinctive from their corrupt environment. They must live transparently upright lives. Otherwise, they are simply going to be ignored. Nehemiah is a superb model in this respect, isn't he? Here was a man who knew that the best way to lead is by example. He didn't say, do as I say, he said, do as I do. Just look at the personal sacrifice he made during his 12 years in office. First, he tells us in verse 10, he lent money and grain to the poor, but unlike his nobles, he was scrupulous to do so interest-free. Secondly, he refused to exercise his tax-raising prerogatives as governor, either in terms of hiding the people's produce or demanding the poll tax that Persian law permitted him to claim. Instead, he supplied the needs of his family, his administrative staff of 150 people, and all his distinguished guests and ambassadors that he was responsible to entertain. He financed the whole thing from his personal resources. He never asked the Jewish community for money. Remarkable, isn't it? Oh, he must have been a wealthy man. Well, he was cupbearer to the emperor. But the fact that he could do that entirely from his own personal resources is a great sacrifice. What's more, he refused to play the role of taskmaster, didn't he? He was a bit like an ancient specimen of modern Japanese management theory. He devotes himself to the work on the wall, doesn't he? You can't imagine there was any sort of separation between management and labour canteens in Nehemiah's community. He didn't just spend his day plotting how he could exploit his government office in order to feather his own nest. He and all his staff had to do their share of the manual labour. And notice he says in verse 16, we did not acquire any land. They weren't permitted to engage in any property deals. Now, any of you who've ever lived in the third world will know how much corruption there is amongst politicians and civil servants in the realm of property deals. Many ex-colonial countries, the white land-owning elite have been replaced in a matter of a single generation by a black land-owning elite. Many a new Commonwealth president manages to stay in office only because, like Hugh the Monarch, he bribes his barons with gifts of land and lucrative posts in the bureaucracy and so on. Now, Nehemiah, as cupbearer to Artaxerxes, had obviously seen the wisdom of the Lord Moses when it said that the king of Israel must not accumulate large amounts of silver and gold or regard himself as superior to his brothers. He must obey the law too. A model of self-sacrificial service that he's left us as a result. And notice what his motive was in this. In verse 18, it's clear that he did it because he was concerned for the people. He saw the demands were heavy on the people and he had compassion on them.
And in verse 15 it's clear that he did it all because he knew it's what God wanted him to do. Out of reverence for God, he said. I couldn't act like the other governors. Well, again, there's a great lesson, isn't there? Do you remember how the early church made such an impact on its social environment? Because of the love they showed to one another, and particularly love in the material realm. No one claimed that any of his possessions were his own. They shared everything they had, and with great power, we're told, the apostles testified to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus. There's a clear connection, you see, between this kind of social concern expressed in the life of God's people and the impact of God's people on the world around them. It's not that the early Christians used charity as a bait on their evangelistic hook, you know, a sugar coating on the evangelistic pill. They weren't interested in multiplying rice Christians. But they were a community which had credibility as the people of God, because they didn't only preach it, they exemplified it in their relations with one another. So much we could learn about that, isn't there? Here we are then, a man confronted by problems within his community. He has an emotional reaction. That gives him energy. He has a rational reaction. That gives him strategy. He has a moral reaction. That gives him authority. He has an exemplary reaction. That gives him credibility. By this, all men will know you are my disciples, and you have love for one another. See, our credibility, too, hinges on whether we love one another.